discussion of, which I mentioned very briefly yesterday, how do we know that the Higgs is a scalar, some spin zero positive parity object? Specifically, we're going to discuss how you would tell the difference between scalar and pseudoscalar. In principle, you would also have to say, could it be spin 2 versus spin 0? You have to test this as well. So we'll just do one particular example. Now, what's the difference between a scalar and a pseudoscalar? Well, for the Higgs, I can write down a variety of couplings, and they have different properties under parity. If it was a pseudoscalar, I couldn't write down those same couplings. I'd have to write down a different set of couplings that respects parity. In particular, I want to talk about one particular coupling, the Higgs coupling to the Z bosons. So if I had a scalar, the Higgs ZZ interaction in the standard, this is in the standard model. It takes the particular form of the Higgs field times Z mu, Z mu. And then there's some overall coupling constant, which I'll just write as C sub S. We know what C sub S is in the standard model. It's like mz squared over the VEV. But we don't really need to put in that constant right now. If the Higgs was a pseudoscalar, we'd have to write down a different structure for this coupling. We would have to write down something in the following form. I need it to have an epsilon tensor, epsilon mu nu alpha beta, and then z mu nu, z alpha beta, and then times h, and then there'll be some other coupling constant. I'll call it Cp for pseudoscalar. So epsilon mu nu alpha beta is antisymmetric tensor. And this object here is like the field strength tensor for the Z. All right. So I have to write down this sort of structure. The antisymmetric index means that I have to couple one time-like component and three spatial components. The spatial components flip sign under parity. And so the whole thing, which involves three spatial components, is parity ought. So that implies that the Higgs scalar is parity odd, to give you a parity conserving term in the Lagrangian. This term, of course, is parity even, z mu, z mu. All right. So the question is, how can we distinguish these two different structures for the coupling? Well, if you measure the total rate, that will tell you about this parameter here. But it doesn't tell you about sort of the Lorentz structure or the derivatives that it might couple to. So the fact that the fact that the experimental measurement for Higgs to ZZ is consistent with what we would predict from the standard model for this parameter suggests that it really is this structure. But it's not a definitive proof. It's not really a direct test of this combination of fields versus this one. So that's what we want to do, test. Which type of interaction is right. All right. So let me write down the matrix element for both of these things. So let me keep two external Lorentz indices. So we'll have mu and alpha. And so this object here will just be this Feynman rule. So I have the Higgs with momentum q. And then it will connects to z with Lorentz index mu, momentum p, and another z with Lorentz index alpha, momentum p prime. And This whole thing is 2i times cs times eta mu alpha for the scalar case. Or it's 4i cp epsilon mu nu alpha beta times momenta p nu p prime beta for the pseudoscalar case. The factors of the momenta come from the derivatives entering into these field strain tensors. All right. So, the interactions couple differently to different polarizations. And so we'll see that this explicitly. So if you have the Higgs decaying into two Z bosons, the Z bosons will have different polarizations in the two different cases. And so we can use the Z polarization in the decay to determine the parity of the Higgs boson. Now, if you just compute the total decay rate, at some point you'll be summing over all possible spins and polarizations, and so this information gets lost. So what we need to do is not consider the total decay rate, but a differential decay rate that will depend on some kinematic information. And this will tell us, this will give us a handle about which polarizations are involved in this particular decay. So here's the process we'll consider. Higgs will go through two Zs, and then each Z will go to a lepton pair. So I'll write it as L, L bar, and L prime bar, where L and L prime are just equal to an electron or a muon. And this is just for experimental convenience, and also for calculational convenience as well, as you'll see in a second. Okay, so let me just sketch, I'll try to sketch this figure. So imagine that we have a Higgs. We're going to be thinking about the frame in which the Higgs is decaying at rest. So okay, for the standard model, one of these objects is off shell, but don't worry about that too much for the moment. So the two Z bosons will go back to back. Like so. So I'll have one with momentum p and one with momentum p prime. And I'm going to assume that this axis here is the z axis. So now each one of these z bosons will decay into two leptons. So sketch this out. So I have one lepton and momentum k1. And then I'll have another lepton, L bar with momentum k2. And this angle here, theta 1, will be the angle for the outgoing lepton with respect to the z-axis in the center of mass frame of the decaying z, z boson. And then similarly, on the other side, I'll have two more leptons going out. So this one will be L prime of K3, and this one will be L prime bar of K4. And okay, I have another decay angle, theta 3. Okay, so we have two vectors here that are going out back to back. Those objects define a plane. So let's suppose that this plane here lies in the plane of the blackboard. So let me try to sketch that plane like so. So this is the decay plane for one half of the diagram. Similarly, on the other side, the two leptons on this side also form a plane. And that plane doesn't have to align exactly with this plane here. So in general, it's tilted by some angle. So it's kind of tilted toward you. I don't know if it's hard to see. So this angle here, I'm going to call phi. So let me write down the variables. So theta 1 and theta 2 are the polar angles in the z rest frame. In each z rest frame. I can also define the azimuthal angles, phi 1 and phi 2, and then I've defined this other angle phi, which is just the difference of the azimuthal angles. Phi 3 minus phi 1 is the relative angle between the decay planes. So here's our goal to compute the following. We have to compute a differential decay rate. And differential with respect to what? With respect to this relative angle phi. So we'll compute the following quantity. This differential rate for this process with respect to phi. Okay, so it looks really complicated. It's like a four-body final state, and we have to compute this differential decay rate. It looks complicated. It is complicated. Now, what we're going to do is consider a simplified version of this problem just to illustrate what might happen, what does happen. And the simplified limit we'll consider. So we'll consider an illustrative limit. And we're going to consider the case where the Higgs mass is actually very heavy instead of being relatively light. So we're going to consider the following case where the Higgs mass is actually much larger than the mass of the Z, which in turn is much larger than the mass of the like a lepton. Okay? So we're not going to be doing exactly the standard model. Just because the standard model, one of these is off-shell, it makes life a lot more complicated. So we'll do this case. So it's not the standard model. So you might say this is totally irrelevant. But that's not quite true, because in the standard model, there's only one Higgs boson at 125 GeV. So OK, it's not the standard model. But in many theories beyond the standard model, you have additional Higgs bosons. So if we find some new heavy scalar, which may have a mass much larger than the mass of the Z, we want to know, is it a scalar or a pseudoscalar? And so this test can be exactly applied to those. OK. So here we'll do a simplified case where we have on-shell Z bosons in the intermediate state. OK. Right. So I alluded to the fact that this has something to do with polarization of the Z boson. So let's talk about Z polarizations. So in the Z rest frame, we have three polarization vectors. And they're just, you know, the basis vectors, x, y, and z. So that's one basis. This is for a z boson at rest. Now let us boost to give the z boson a given momentum. So we'll so this will be the z boson on the right there as a function of p. The momentum is just aligned along the z direction. And so now I can just boost each of these polarization vectors. The boost doesn't do anything to the first two polarizations. And it only affects the third polarization, which becomes the longitudinal polarization. And this polarization vector is beta times gamma, 0, 0, gamma. So these are transverse polarizations. And this one here is longitudinal. So let me mention, just for completeness, beta is equal to, beta gamma is equal to the energy divided by the mass, and gamma is, this was gamma, this is the momentum divided by the mass.
Sure.
Yeah.
Is it possible?
Yeah, definitely. Thank you. Okay, now we can do the same thing. So this is one of the z's. Let's also write down the polarization vectors for z of p prime. So we have epsilon 1 mu p prime is just equal to 0, 1, 0, 0. Epsilon 2 mu of p prime is 0, 0, 1, 0. And the only difference here is the longitudinal polarization. So instead of boosting this direction, we just have to boost in the other direction. So you just set beta to minus beta. So we have minus beta gamma, 0, 0, gamma. But it's the same, same gamma and beta for both cases. OK. So now that we have these polarization vectors, what I'll do is I'll contract them with this matrix element for these two different cases, and we'll see which ones contribute and which ones don't. We'll define the following. Higgs decaying into two z's of a given polarization labeled by I and j. And this is just the matrix element that I wrote before with the Lorentz indices floating around, contracted with the polarization vectors. And so this is the following. For the scalar case, I have epsilon I of p dotted into epsilon j of p prime. And for the pseudoscalar case, I have everything is contracted with an antisymmetric tensor. P nu, p prime beta, epsilon I mu of p, epsilon alpha j of p prime. So let's evaluate these things for all of the different combinations of polarizations. So for the scalar case, it's always proportional to this, the two polarization vectors dotted into one another. Now, if I have two transverse polarizations, first of all, they have to be the same, otherwise I'll get zero. So it's equal to minus one if I is equal to j is equal to one or two. They're the same. If they're the two longitudinal polarizations, and remember they're different vectors, so this one dotted into this one, I don't get minus one. I get the following. I get minus gamma squared 1 plus beta squared. This is for the longitudinal polarization. And then I get zero otherwise, if any of them are different. So one of these is largest. In the limit, in the sort of fictitious limit that we're taking, where the Higgs is much heavier than the mass of the Z, this gamma factor is much larger than one, and so it's this longitudinal contribution, which ends up being the largest. This one is dominant for gamma, much, much greater than one, in the limit that MH is much larger than the Z. Okay, so it's dominated by the longitudinal parts. Now let's do the same thing for the pseudoscalar. Right. So let's look at the pseudoscalar expression. P and P prime are oriented along the Z direction. So the only non-zero components is the time-like component and the three components. So that means the polarization vectors have to either be in the one or two components. And specifically, one of them has to be one and the other has to be two, just due to antisymmetry. So the only ones that contribute are the transverse polarizations. So either I is equal to 1 and j is equal to 2, or I is equal to 2 and j is equal to 1. Those are the only combinations you can have. So the matrix elements into these two polarizations is 4 Cp epsilon mu nu alpha beta p nu p prime beta epsilon 1 mu epsilon 2 nu. The epsilon, the polarization vectors are the same for either p and p prime. So by antisymmetry, this is just equal to minus the matrix element for Higgs decaying into Z2, Z1. Let me be a little bit more clear here. When the first Z here represents the one with momentum P, and the other one represents the one with momentum P prime. So let me try to be a little more clear. Okay, so this is what I mean. Okay, so I've convinced you that for the two different interactions, you will decay into different polarization vectors for the Zs. Now what I want to discuss is how the polarization imprints itself on the distribution of the leptons, the angular distribution of the leptons that are coming out. So what we'll consider is the fact that polarization determines angular distribution. For the leptons. So let's say we have a Z with polarization I and momentum P going into two leptons. So what we're going to do is compute the decay rates for Z to decay into these two leptons. And you've already done this calculation for the case where you average over all initial polarizations of the Z. We're not going to do that here. We're going to take one particular polarization and compute the decay rates. In particular, we're going to compute the differential decay rate. That's the quantity we're interested in. Okay, so this is 1 over 64 pi squared mz, and then I have to integrate over the angles, sum over the fermion spins, times the matrix element squared. Now, let me write down this matrix element. So, like this. So I have a Z with Lorentz index mu, and it couples to L like this. So we're just writing down the Feynman rule. Feynman rule is I times G over 4 cosine theta W gamma mu. And then we have 1 minus 4 sine squared theta W times 1, then minus gamma 5. So there's kind of a numerical coincidence. I don't know if you know about this, but experimentally, sine squared theta w is around 0.23. This is approximately 1/4. So the quantity 1 minus 4 sine squared theta w is approximately 0. OK, something like 10 to the minus 2. All right? So for the purposes that we have here, it's safe to neglect the vector part of the interaction compared to the much larger axial part of the interaction. That will make our life simpler. So the Feynman rule is just minus I g over 4 sine theta w gamma mu times gamma 5. This will make it a lot easier to compute these traces over gamma matrices. This quantity 1 minus 4 sine squared theta w is known as the weak charge of the electron, or the muon. They're the same. So it's just a fact of the standard model and a fact of the parameters, the numerical values of the parameters, that the weak charge of the electron just turns out to be suppressed by this coincidence. Okay, so let's compute the following. We have the sum over the fermion spins times the matrix element squared. For the purposes of this discussion, we actually don't even really need the overall constants in front. So we're only going to be dealing with proportionalities. So this is proportional to the following. I have a polarization vector. I have a u momentum k, a u bar momentum k, 1, gamma mu, gamma 5, and then v with momentum k2. So we're just dropping the overall coefficients in front. Okay. Oh, and then I have to square it. Sorry, so let me not write this like this. Write it as follows. So now we're going to square this matrix element. Let's also work in the z center of mass frame. So that tells me that k1 is equal to, it's massless, so I can write this as k times k vector, and then k2 would just be equal to, sorry, let me write it like this. And this is equal to k1, since the energies have to be the same, and then minus k1 vector, like so. OK, so we'll square the matrix element. It'll be proportional to epsilon I mu. Epsilon I nu star. Then I have a trace of k1 slash gamma mu gamma 5, k2 slash gamma nu gamma 5 end trace. And we can evaluate the trace. This whole thing is proportional to 2 times k1 dotted into ei, and then k2 dotted into ei star. The star doesn't matter because all of our polarization vectors are real. Then we have minus epsilon I dotted into epsilon I star, and then we have k1 dotted into k2. So the norm of a polarization vector is always minus 1. So this whole thing is minus 1. This quantity here is just mh squared over 2. So this object is mh squared over 2 minus 2 k1 dotted into epsilon I, k2 dotted into epsilon I. Now, in the rest frame of the Z, the polarization vectors are just basis vectors in three-dimensional space. So when I write down polarization vector I, that's just basis vector I, x, y, or z. It's just picking out, and when I dot it into k, a momentum, it will just pick out that particular component of the momentum, the ith component of the three momentum. So this object here is mz squared over 2 minus 2 times k1i, and then k, actually it's just squared. Sorry, this should be a plus sign here. This is plus. So the two spatial components of the momenta just have an overall minus sign, and so I get an extra minus sign here once I write k2 instead of k1. Okay, so hopefully it's clear what this means. K1i is just the ith spatial component, so the x, y, and z. Is it clear what this means? I'm not really sure. No? Yes?
K1.k2, it's mz squared over 2, not mh.
Yeah, mz. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, sorry. I didn't mean to write mh. Thank you. Mz squared. Otherwise, it's clear?
So can you repeat again the meaning of the last k?
Yeah. Well, let me just expand this. I think it'll be clear. So this is the energy component, and then I have k1 x, k1 y, k1 z. And so this is k minus k1 x minus k1 y minus k1 z. So this I here would just go over 1, 2, 3, or x, y, z. It's just these components here. That's what I mean by this. And the minus sign just comes from the fact that in K2, the spatial components just have the opposite sign since we're working in the Z rest frame. Okay. So what I want is to figure out how this matrix element squared depends on the angular distributions. And so instead of writing it in terms of, you know, Cartesian momenta, let me rewrite it in terms of angular variables. So I'll write k1 vector as k1 and then some angles, sine theta 1, cosine phi 1, sine theta 1, sine phi 1, and then cosine phi 1. So I'm just expanding the momentum k1 in terms of spherical angular variables. And then this energy, k1, is just mz over 2. It's the magnitude of the momentum, or equal to the energy, since the lepton is massless. OK. So for all of the different cases of the polarization vector, I can just plug in this momentum here and evaluate what the matrix element squared is in terms of these angles. So if I have a longitudinal mode, in the Z rest frame, the longitudinal polarization is just the three component, or the pointing along the Z direction. And so I just plug in the Z component here. And so this whole thing is just proportional to mz squared over 2, 1 minus cosine squared theta 1. I can do the same exercise for the transverse polarizations. Now I just take the one component squared. And then for the two components, the two polarization, I just take the two components squared. Okay. So this information tells us that the different polarizations will have a different angular dependence in their differential decay rate. So that corresponds to what's in parentheses here, the different dependencies on the angle. Now, remember, we're interested ultimately in the dependence on the relative as a mutual coordinate. So it'll be phi 3 minus phi 1. And so I want to look at the dependence of these matrix elements on the azimuthal angles. So you can see, although this is only one half of the diagram, the azimuthal angles only appear for the transverse polarizations. So you can already see straight away that if we have a longitudinal z decaying, it's not going to depend on the azimuthal angle. So there will be no dependence on this difference of the decay planes compared to if we have a transverse polarization, there is some dependence, which we still need to work out. So only transverse modes depend on the azimuthal angles. In this case, it's just phi 1 for this half. Now, when we write down the full decay amplitude for the Higgs decaying into two Zs, and then those two Zs go into four leptons, we'll also have to involve some interference terms as well, which you'll see how those crop up. And so for future reference, it's also useful to compute another set of amplitudes squared, which corresponds to an interference type of diagram. So we'll consider the fermion, sum over fermion spins of the following object. So I'll take the matrix element for Z1 decaying into LL bar, and then the matrix element for Z2 going into LL bar star. So this would be like an interference type term, and you'll see how this comes up, but let's just start by computing it. So it's proportional to the following. So the only change I need to make is instead of having the same I here, I just need to swap one of them to be 1 and the other one to be 2, and then plug that in. So it's proportional to 2 k1 dotted into epsilon 1, k2 dotted into epsilon 2 star, minus epsilon 1 dotted into epsilon 2 star, and then k1 dotted into k2. So these two polarization vectors are different, so this dot product is 0. Second term can be neglected. And so I just get minus 2 times k1x times k1y. Since the epsilon 1 will pick out the x component, epsilon 2 will pick out the y component, which has an extra minus sign because it's k2. Okay, and now I can write that in terms of the angular coordinates. And so this quantity here is proportional to minus mz squared over 2 times sine squared theta 1 times sine phi 1 cosine phi 1. Okay. So this is... this is all we need to know. And so now we just need to put these pieces, these different pieces together to compute this full differential decay rate. So here's the matrix element that we want. And I can write it together as a product of the individual amplitudes for the different steps in this diagram. So what I would do is I would say I compute the matrix element for the Higgs to decay into two Zs of a given polarization I and J. And then I write the matrix element for polarization I to decay into L bar, the matrix element for ZJ to decay into L prime bar, like this. But then I need to sum over all of the different possibilities for the intermediate states. In this case, it's the different polarizations for the Zs. And so I would sum over the different polarizations. There's other factors as well in this matrix element, which I'm omitting. In particular, you need to include the propagator for one of the outgoing Zs here to become one of the incoming Zs here. So I'm neglecting additional propagators for the Z bosons. But it's going to be irrelevant for what I will discuss. Now, let's square this matrix element. So we'll start out with the case of the scalar interaction. So only the longitudinal polarizations will contribute. So I'll sum over fermion spins. So I just need to write down, so since for this case only the longitudinal polarizations are important, there's only one term for each of these things. I can just square them. I just need to square each term. So it's proportional to the matrix element squared for Higgs decaying into two longitudinal Zs. And then I have a sum over the fermion polarization, the fermion spins for one longitudinal Z to decay. And then I sum over the fermion spins for the other one to decay. I only need to care about the angular dependence. That's the only part I'm going to be worrying about. This whole thing just depended on betas and gammas. Those depend on the energies. Nothing here depends on angle. Here, these two terms depend on angle, so I'll just plug in what we got. It's given by the top line there. So it's proportional to 1 minus cosine squared theta 1, and then times 1 minus cosine squared theta 3. For the other half of the diagram, the results are exactly the same as what I got over here. I just need to relabel with the appropriate angle. Just theta 3 instead of theta 1, phi 3 instead of phi 1. Now, you can see in this matrix element squared, there's no dependence on the azimuthal angle. So this implies that the differential cross-section versus this relative azimuthal angle must be constant. So this is a, okay. That's the case of the scalar interaction. Now we'll do the pseudo-scalar interaction. So it's a little bit more involved. So what you want to do is sum over the fermion spins for this matrix element. And it's proportional to the following. So I have to, again, divide up the matrix element into a product of three terms and then sum over the polarizations for the amplitude. So I have the following. Higgs decaying into Zi, Zj. And then the matrix element for Zi to go to LL bar. And then the matrix element for Zj to go to L prime bar. And I need to sum over the intermediate polarizations, all possible intermediate polarizations. And so I need to write the sum over I and J. But of course, for the case of the pseudoscalar interaction, we only need the transverse parts. So I just need to sum over 1 and 2. In particular, I need to have, well, I can write it down. So I need to have I is equal to 1, j is equal to 2, or I is equal to 2, j is equal to 1. Those are the only two possibilities that are allowed. I need to sum over those, add them up, and then square that whole thing, and then sum over the fermion spins for the final states. So let me write it out. So this object here is proportional to the amplitude for the Higgs to decay into Z1, Z2 squared. And then I want to sum over the fermion spins. Then I have the matrix element for Z1 to decay into LL bar, the matrix element for Z2 to decay into L prime bar, and then minus the matrix element for Z2 to decay into LL bar, and the matrix element for Z1 to decay into L prime bar, and then square that. Okay? So, what I did to get this expression is the following. So the first term, so when I sum over the intermediate polarizations, I'll have the sum of two terms, okay? So one will be 1, 2, and the other one will be 2, 1. Now what I'm doing is factoring out the first matrix element, the one for the Higgs decay, using the fact that if I flip around the two polarizations, 1, 2 goes to 2, 1, I just pick up an overall minus sign. And so that one will just factor out of the overall expression, and I'll just have that expression squared. But that leaves this extra minus sign here, which comes from the fact that if, due to the antisymmetry of the interaction, if I flip around the polarizations, I introduce a minus sign. Okay. So let's keep going. And so I have this matrix element here up front. And then I have the following. So I'm just going to square this whole object. So I have the sum over the fermion spins of Z1 to LL bar times. So I'm going to do the first term squared. And then I'll do the second term squared. And then I have the cross term, which is minus twice the real part, sum over the fermion spins. I have Z1 going into LL bar times Z2 going into LL bar star, and then Z2 going into L prime bar, and then Z1 going into L prime bar star. So I have these terms to write down. And so now what I'm going to do is use all of these relations for plugging in terms of the angles. So the whole thing, I'll have a bunch of overall constants, which I'll ignore. Now the first term gives me the following. 1 minus sine squared theta 1 cosine squared phi 1. So that's this term squared. And then for this term squared, I just have the same similar expression, but I just have to replace cosine by sine. And I have to replace the ones by threes. The next term is 1 minus sine squared theta 1 sine squared phi 1, 1 minus sine squared theta 3 cosine squared phi 3. And then I have the cross term, just sine squared theta 1, sine squared theta 3, sine phi 1, cosine phi 1, sine phi 3, cosine phi 3. Okay. So this is the full angular dependence of the differential decay rate in terms of all of the kinematic angles. Let me simplify this expression a little bit. So there's a lot of stuff in front. And then I have cosine squared theta 1 plus cosine squared theta 3 plus sine squared theta 1 sine squared theta 3 times sine squared phi 3 minus phi 1. So everything in parentheses here can be expressed as this, slightly more simplified way. And so you see the appearance of this angle which we had been chasing. The difference in the azimuthal angles between the two decay planes is this angle phi. So it appears for the case of the pseudoscalar decay. And so the differential decay rate will depend on phi. So what we want is to compute this differential decay rate. And so we need to integrate over all of the remaining kinematic variables. In particular, we need to integrate over the polar angles, d theta 1, or like this, integrate over d cos theta 1, d cos theta 3, which are the polar angles. So So in that case, we get the following expression. So so when we integrate over the polar angles of everything that I wrote down in parentheses, it's proportional to 1 minus 1 quarter cosine 2 phi. So this is really the answer here. Once I've figured this out, it's straightforward to write down the differential decay rate. So in this case, I get the differential decay rate for this process. Just be a little more clear. So let me just write gamma to be the partial width for the process that I'm interested in. And the differential decay rate must be equal to gamma over 2 pi times 1 minus 1 fourth cosine 2 phi. All we figured out was this part in parentheses, 1 minus 1 quarter cosine 2 phi. The overall factor in front is just required by the fact that once I integrate over the last kinematic variable phi, it must be equal to the total decay rate. And so if I integrate over phi, this part will integrate to 0, and I'll just get a factor of 2 pi. Okay, so that fixes the overall coefficient. I don't need to worry about the overall coefficients at all. Okay? And so this is the answer for the pseudoscalar case. And the same thing for the scalar case. It was just equal to a constant. That constant has to be the decay rate over 2 pi. If I integrate over phi, it must give me a factor of 2 pi. To return the decay rate itself. So this is the different angular dependence. So if I measure something like the event rate, which is related to the differential the decay rate, and I plot it as a function of this angle, for the case of a scalar, I'll just get a straight line. But for the case of a pseudoscalar, I don't get a straight line. I have this dependence. It looks like this. And so by measuring, you know, the difference of these decay planes, or the rate as a function of the difference in angle of these decay planes, that would tell me, is it a scalar or a pseudoscalar? OK. So that's all for today. We're going to talk about something else tomorrow. Yes?
When we consider the case where the Higgs is not as, like, we don't put his mass, like, super big, do we have as a big contrast in the decay rate?
No, we don't. So not only is the calculation much more complicated, but there isn't as big of a difference in the two behaviors. But still, one can make this distinction, but it requires a lot more work. So what you need to do is not consider the decay rate as a function of just this one angular variable, but you need to consider the full dependence on all of the angular variables. And so by using the maximum amount of information, and also not just in this one decay channel to ZZ, but to WW and all other states as well, you can sort of tease this out. But it's much more challenging.
Thank you.